your showcase.
Okay, hello everyone, and welcome back to Millennial 2022, Millennial 8, and I'm now using the big proper camera so that you will notice a difference, and I'm wearing my fluffy shawl just so that people understand why I look like this, and excellent, I'm now here with Dave Martell of the Bizarchives. So Dave Martell, welcome to Millennial. It's been a while coming. I've meant to invite you in previous years, but for various reasons, it hasn't happened until now. So welcome at last.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, man. I'm feeling good, feeling blessed. It's an honor to be here.
All right, great. I guess the first question is to introduce you to people is, let's hear about you first before we get into the Bizarchives. So I'd like to introduce yourself.
Yeah, well, for folks that might not be familiar, my name's Dave Martell. I am a podcaster. I've been in the circuit for quite a few years now, doing various things, had various projects. A lot of folks might be familiar with me from my show that I ran for a few years called The Bog, which was over on my YouTube channel. I've worked with various other folks, worked with the Neurona Society. You know, I've been in the game for a while, and as of right now, I am the editor-in-chief of the Bizarchives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines, as well as one half of the Culture Dads and Age of Sword Cassette that I do with Mr. Mike from the Imperium Press, my boy that you had on last night. So, yeah, that's me, and that's what I do.
All right. So I guess the first question is, what is the Bizarchives?
Yeah, well, the Bizarchives is a small publishing company that I started a couple years ago, and we focus on the old school pulp genres, or should I say traditions of fiction, being, you know, a fantasy, cosmic horror, science fiction, these kinds of things that are reminiscent of the pulp genres that were around in what we call the golden age of fiction, which was about in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And we very much fancy ourselves to be a reincarnation of my personal favorite and a lot of folks' personal favorites publication, which was called Weird Tales Magazine, which a lot of folks are probably going to be familiar with. This is the publication that spawned such literary greats as H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, and many, many, many more. So it was a real trendsetter and a game changer, and my personal favorite from that era that went on to inspire so many other great things. I'm a big fan of pulp fiction, and more specifically of weird fiction, these kinds of things.
Let's get this clear, just for obviously, it's a very obvious thing to say, but just in case anyone does get confused, when you say pulp fiction, you're not referring to the 1995 film by Quentin Tarantino. So what is pulp? Go for it. Yeah.
So pulp fiction is, like I said before, it was a medium from which literature was produced back in those times, the 20s, 30s, and 40s. This is now referred to as the golden age of fiction. And when you hear the word pulp fiction, it's not the movie. What pulp fiction is referring to is the specific type of magazine or book that these stories and this literature was printed on.
Was it cheap paper? Was it like?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what the word implies.
Yeah, so I actually have a cultural artifact right here I'd like to show you guys here. I have this is from late era of pulp. Now that, you know, there's some green and yellow in there, so it's got with the green screen. But this is a copy of Fantastic Adventures. I believe this is 1949, and it's very, very fragile. What these publications were printed on, which is what was called pulp paper. And it was effectively paper that was pressed out of the leftover pulp, wood pulp, that was in, and as you can see, it's very delicate. It did not age very well. It was made to be very, very cheap. And these were also called dime novels because they cost between a nickel and a quarter. And this style of fiction, this was everywhere. Every newsstand, every gas station, everywhere. This is what the people read back then. And it started out mostly as like westerns and mobster stories and war stories and stuff like that. And then as the years went on, when you get into the 30s, you start seeing a lot more of what we would understand to be pulp or weird or fantasy fiction, being H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, L. Ron Hubbard before he was an evil cult leader. There's lots of these guys. You know, obviously, I mentioned H.P. Lovecraft. A lot of these guys were pulp writers, and from this spawned pretty much everything that we know in pop culture today. Everything from pop culture, at least everything good, spawned from pulp fiction. So when we say pulp today, we're not necessarily talking about this paper specifically, this style of paper, this pulp paper. Pulp today is sort of like a vibe. It's sort of like it implies a short form adventure style fiction. It usually implies things that are books that are a little bit more affordable. It's just like a vibe today. It's not so much exactly pulp fiction, pulp paper as you would see in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. It's kind of its own thing now. And it kind of went out of style with the mass production paperbacks in the 50s and 60s, and then going into the 70s and 80s. I'm sure guys out there that are big fans of Conan the Barbarian or these types of authors will be familiar with Ace paperbacks, which these little cheap paperbacks that came out that cost, you know, like $1.50, stuff like that. And they're still around, and I still collect them, actually. Edgar Rice Burroughs, he was a big pulp guy that made his way into the Ace paperbacks, the mass production paperbacks. But it went out of style in that way, and it led into what we would understand to be magazines and comic books. The original pulp magazines were sort of proto those things. It was before those things existed, inspired all of that. So everything from comic book heroes to in fact, almost all comic book heroes today are literally just plagiarisms of the old pulp heroes. The Shadow, Doc Savage, Captain Future, these kinds of characters. And I actually have here's a few reprints. If you do want to get copies, I have reprints. Like here's Weird Tales right here. This is a reprint from 1925. I have Science Wonder Stories. Yeah, I collect these things. I love it because I believe that these are very, very influential. This was the big bang of pop culture, this golden age of fiction that went on to inspire a lot of stuff, do a lot of genres that we probably wouldn't attribute to this. The spaghetti westerns, mafia movies, a lot of like music genres draw inspiration from this. So this was a really big bang of literature and art that happened, and it was a folk art as well. This was not pulp fiction was considered a lowbrow by the highfalutin people.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask. And presumably, it's not stuff that would be regarded as particularly deep intellectually, but it's deep in other ways.
So, here's the thing with pulp fiction back then: they produced so much of it that it's kind of hard to it would be like today if you said MP3s are lowbrow or MP3s are high art or whatever. MP3 is just a medium.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
MP3
yeah.
could be anything. And this is what pulp was. Pulp could just be anything. And like anything, most of it was not very good, because when you get into just about anything, most of it's not very good, because that's just the way that it is when you mass produce something.
Of course.
However, the greats that came out of these eras were fantastic. You know, I mentioned H.P. Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft was he belongs on the Mount Rushmore of, in my opinion, of greatest Western writers of the modern era. He's the way that he wrote, he changed the game. He redefined how we not just how we write and create horror and this type of genre, but how we conceptualize it, how he could, like, he really brought a new level of conceptualization in that art form that just completely redefined it. And this is why the leftoids, when they spurg and kvetch about Lovecraft and his supposed, you know, evil outdated beliefs, he's uncancelable. They can't get rid of him because he's part of the infrastructure. He's immortal.
Yeah, let me ask you one, just going back a bit. You said that it was pulp paper, but it was the leftovers. Could you elaborate on that? Because I really like that idea. Could you go into that?
Yeah, so they used to have these, you know, big paper mills, right? And they would make paper for things that you use paper for. And then there was a byproduct that was left over. They would take the parts of the wood that were good to make the paper, and there was this byproduct, and it was this big, chunky, rough-cut, this junk, right, this slop. And what they're like, hey, we also got to keep in mind, the time of pulp, this is the time of the Great Depression. This is the time of poverty that was in the West, not just in America, but in Great Britain, which where there's a, you know, big pulp scene there too. This was a time where regular people were very poor. They were, you know, it was a tough time to be alive. So they had to be very resourceful. So what they did is they scraped up all of this pulp that was off of the floor, and they pressed it into this paper, which is it's almost like a mix between newsprint and construction paper. It was junk, but it was what the people read. And to give people to like illustrate how important this stuff was to the regular people. When we go to school, right? We go to school. What books do we get? What do we read? What fiction do we read? We get introduced to Great Gatsby. We get introduced to Of Mice and Men, Catcher in the Rye, considered modern classics, right? These were books that our teachers tell us to read. We got to read these things, et cetera, et cetera. Well, to illustrate how much the people liked pulp, The Great Gatsby, which, you know, the literary department people will tell you is the greatest book ever written, sold between when it came out, I believe, when did it come out? 1936 or something like that, until Fitzgerald died, like, yeah, I guess 20, 30 years later, it sold a total of 30,000 copies. When Weird Tales magazine that I just showed you would often sell 100,000 copies in a month. That's how much people loved pulp fiction. This was folk art. This was the people's fiction. This is what Joe Schmo read. This is what the people were reading. They couldn't afford the big books. They liked pulp.
That's quite a remarkable comparison there. What you mentioned Weird Tales and Weird Fiction, and I know that was the name of an actual publication. But what is meant by the word weird in terms of fiction? What is this genre?
So within pulp, there's like a lot of different... Pulp is interesting because it existed before genres existed. So you have a lot of stories that just are kind of just a blending of genres. You have guys that are sailing across different planets doing sword fights. You have medieval times, and there's aliens and robots. There's just, they blend a lot of crazy. There's a lot of gonzo crazy stuff going on back that people were just very imaginative. So it was it was like before genres existed. So when you look at pulp genres or genres that exist within the umbrella of pulp, it's a little bit like, you know, it's kind of tough because things cross over. And blah, blah, blah. But when we're talking about weird fiction, it differentiates from standard pulp fiction insofar as pulp fiction generally implies what we would now understand to be like adventure stories or adventure tales or something like that. Whereas weird fiction is more in the realm of something like what they would call wonder tales. So the way that I describe this is when we talk about weird tales, we have to take it back to the etymology. The word weird comes from the Old English word beard, right? Weird, which means it's referencing the weird sisters, the web of weird. It referenced fate. And weird in the Saxon term is cognate to a few different other concepts, theological concepts. One of them being from the ancient Germanics would call this erlog or overlaw. And the Hindus would call this dharma, right? These are the principles of of reality that kind of order things, right? These are, it is the overlord. It's natural law. It is the pressures or the operating system or whatever, however you want to describe it, that orders reality as we know it in our relationship with reality. So when we say something is weird today, obviously when in common parlance, we know that weird just means like, okay, well, this is a little off kilter. It's a little strange or whatever, but it still has the same meaning. When you say something that's weird, what you're saying is this is kind of outside of weird. This is something that is surreal or unreal or part of subnormality, or this is something that this is kind of out of place with our understanding of reality, right? This is why a lot of times weird fiction today has a lot of what we would understand like psychedelic aesthetics and stuff like that. So when we're talking about weird, we're talking about something that involves the psychedelia, things that are more I don't want to say intellectual, cerebral, I guess you could say, more involved with dreams and weird concepts. And it also includes alternative histories. This is why Conan fits perfectly in weird fiction, because, you know, Conan in his time, the Age of Hyboria, there's Sumerians there, there's Shemites, there's like all of these like ancient antediluvian supposed things that he jammed together and created this weird world. So this is weird fiction, is something that is unreal or kind of not real. It's weird. You're muted, Mr. Wes.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Right. That is an interesting summary of it, because when I was thinking that it was going to be sort of Lovecraftian, which leads on to things like Stephen King.
Sure.
What would you say about that relationship?
So Lovecraft is absolutely he's a pillar of weird fiction. Like the guy, you can't have today, we can't even talk about weird fiction without talking about Lovecraft. It's just, you just can't have it. This guy, you know, the concept of cosmic horror is such an important concept. You know, half of the sci-fi movies in the 80s were like trying to
well make... let's talk about that then, because let's get that defined. What's cosmic horror? Talk about that before we go on to the Stephen King and whatever.
Sure. Man, cosmic horror is built off of a philosophy that Lovecraft sort of penned, which is called cosmicism. This idea, pretty much what cosmic horror is, obviously it's horror, and it deals with antagonists or pressures that come from elsewhere in the cosmology, right? Other dimensions, outer space, other planes of existence, all of this kind of stuff. And cosmic horror has to do with bending and challenging our understanding of reality, right? Those of you guys out there that are Lovecraft fans will know this was like Lovecraft's thing, right? Things that are so big and so massive that they don't even realize that we exist, that we're like grains of sand on a beach, and like we're just like nothingness. We mean nothing. And these gigantic, monstrous, primordial entities could just like destroy us and not even notice. Like, now we're just like ants to them. So this kind of stuff, things like bending time, bending geometry. A lot of times Lovecraft will call things like non-Euclidean geometry, like geometry that doesn't even like have shape, and cyclopean forms, and, you know, the things that are just beyond comprehension, right? This was so, you know, it was just like, it was so out there and genius back then that it just changed the way everybody was like trying to be Lovecraft after that. Like, he just changed the game. And even today, this is, you know, it's like, I am so fascinated by, like, it seems like every few years there's like another upcropping of like Lovecraft fanatics. They get called to, like, the cult of Cthulhu calls to them, you know, the dreaming one. He speaks to the sensitive few, and like every generation there just comes another like Lovecraft cult comes up and gets all worked up with, because it's like these concepts are so like what is bigger than that? What goes further than that? How could we fathom something that is more incredible and massive and monstrous than like Azathoth slumbering at the center of the universe, right? Like these kinds of things. Like, how could you come up with something bigger than that? And that is why, like, stuff like Lovecraft, like, people are just going to be loving this until the end of time. You can go to the year, you know, 4022, and people are going to think, you know, Lovecraft is dope.
Well, what is the relationship? Because I was surprised when you said that it ended in the sort of 40s, because I was thinking, well, it sounds like it's going to link to the 50s, the craze for science fiction in the 50s and 60s. What happened there?
So pulp did not really the medium of pulp, like the actual how they printed the magazines went out. There's a few different it got knocked off by better technology, the mass production paperbacks, and also they used that wood pulp. I can't remember exactly why, but they actually needed that wood pulp for war efforts, so they had to like start using it, so they started confiscating it, right? They couldn't use it anymore, so they'd come up with something else. So post-World War, you start getting you know, these mass production paperbacks, and then you start getting into comic books, and it went on and on and on. And if you go into the 80s, pulp survives in things like Tales from the Crypt and Heavy Metal Magazine and, you know, all of the wonderful animated movies that we liked back then. Fire and Ice, Gandahar, et cetera, et cetera.
That was one thing I wanted to pick up on was there are those magazines from the 50s, 60s, which are hilarious to look at now, that sort of men's adventure magazines where they've got hilarious cover illustrations and hilarious storylines mentioned, like I was lost in the jungle with a tribe of Amazonian sex crazed women and I battled a crocodile and all, you know, all this kind of absolutely hilarious over the top stuff. Does that fit into this to pulp?
Absolutely. I actually have it's probably not going to show up because it's yellow, but High Adventure magazine.
This kind of stuff with all the scantily clad women, time after time after time.
Oh yeah, it was hilarious. It's bro stuff. Yeah, you know, you got big jacked heroes, you know, punching crocodiles in the face and strangling grizzly bears and sexy ladies with their boobies out and weird monsters that are getting blasted in outer space. Like, it's just like, it's like all the things that regular guys like, just combined together into this this badass amalgamate and cranked up all the way to the max. And that's why guys liked it. And also on top of it, it was good writing. It was good writing. Not all of it, obviously, but some of it was like really romantic in its style and its prose in a way that just didn't click for the modernist literary you know, guys that stuck their nose up at it, right? They, oh, it's lowbrow, et cetera, et cetera. Or maybe you guys are just boring and kind of gay. Maybe that's it.
Well, maybe a bit of both, but it's it is funny to think of that interaction, like, how they would perceive something like this, because it, I mean, when you see these covers now, it looks amazing. It looks it's both things at once. You know, on the one hand, it's ridiculous and sort of laughable, but on the other hand, clearly it's exciting.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no denying that.
Exactly, and that's that's something that I just thought was so special about this old school pulp is, yes, it was kind of silly. Not all of it. Some of it was serious. You know, like I said, it's all over the place. But some of it was really silly and absurd and cartoonish and just over the top. But it was also authentic. Right. There was something authentic about it. They weren't trying. They weren't being ironic or whatever. They're like, this is badass. Guys are going to love this. You know what I mean? So they just drew this and wrote this stuff because they wanted to entertain the reader. And I think that when authors and writers forgot that their first job was to entertain the reader is when literacy and reading books kind of left regular people behind.
Well, we've seen a similar thing recently with in TV drama, film, where it goes woke, and I don't like the term, but I'm using it for brevity.
Yeah,
and they seem to have forgotten that the first thing they're supposed to be doing is entertaining their audience, so that it's actually an enjoyable experience and not fucking terrible dirge. And as a result, you have things like, you know, the Rings of Power, which seem to have been a dismal failure because in a different way they're preaching to they're trying to reshape their audience.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Rings of Power is just an absolute blasphemy to the masterwork, you know, the masterpiece that Mr. Tolkien created. Rings of Power. I refused to watch it. I was not going to watch that. I'm not going to watch the new Willow. I'm a huge fan of the old Willow movie. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yeah, I did. And I saw Dark Crystal as well.
those are just beautiful, wholesome pieces of our childhood. And I can't stomach watching what these midwit, talentless hacks are going to do to it. I just can't do it.
That was another thing I wanted to ask you. You mentioned that in the 80s, that was a sort of callback to this genre in cinema. Would you talk about that a bit? And then, because then I want to mention Stranger Things, which seems to be calling back to the 80s in turn. So it's interesting.
So I kind of penned. So there was after the World Wars, obviously there was fiction never really went away. People were still reading fiction and stuff like that. But it really came back in force, and not just fiction, but art all over the place came back in force between this age that I call this is like the postmodern golden age, which is between 1975 and 1995. We get like all of the best movies ever made, some of the best bands ever, the best albums, like the best stuff ever that we created in our epoch, like came out of this, right? You got Terminator, you got Slayer, you got Black Sabbath, you got the list goes on. Like everything awesome came out during this time. You know, it all kind of like died off during the invention of the internet, and we go into the epoch of hypermodernity, and then there's a lot of other things too that really ruined it, like the Telecommunications Act in 1995, where they did the radio homogenization and consolidated all the radio stations, so they played was just like corpo garbage, top 40 stuff, and you could no longer, the local DJ no longer played the awesome local bands that you would go see at the bar, the venue, or whatever. Which, by the way, you know, I think that having that layer of folk art, that substrata of folk art, things like Pulp Fiction, things like your awesome local band that probably isn't going to go on to get a big deal and tour the world, but for your locality, they're badass and they put on a good show. Like having that soil, that fertile soil of creativity spawns greats like, you know, Lovecraft or Led Zeppelin or Black Sabbath, you know, whoever. And this is something that we see all throughout history. You know, Da Vinci and Michelangelo came from the same town. Like they came from Florence, and like they were born a few years from each other or something like that. Right. There's no coincidence that having this like fertile soil, this substrata of folk art, of this kind of like thriving community of art, creates this great stuff. So I kind of forget what the original question was. I started ranting.
I was asking you about the 80s and reaching back to the Pulp Fiction. Yeah. You and I come from a similar area. I definitely have a lot of very fond memories. Everyone knows that I'm into science fiction. If you didn't know, you could tell from the T-shirt I'm wearing right now, which is about RoboCop. There you go. And yeah, it was a wonderful... I mean, you know, Zoomers... It's understandable. As people age, it can be a bit tragic that they're so attached to the past. And when you're young and you see like a 40-year-old talking about his childhood... I understand it. It can seem rather tragic. But at the same time, the 80s really was a fucking cool, incredibly cool decade. And the 90s had definitely cool in a different way. Far, far cooler than the 2000s. I mean, I cannot tell the Zoomers how fucking awful a decade the 2000s was.
Yeah.
And the 2010s. Sorry. And I'm not even saying this to, you know, as a jibe, I'm just saying it as a fact. The 2000s was a cultural desert compared to the 90s, which in turn was, let's just say the 80s was cool in a different way. But the point is that the 80s, very much a sci-fi decade, but also very much a fantasy decade. And fantastic, you know, to be a child then was to be surrounded by just incredible worlds, one after another, in Hollywood cinema, and in TV as well, at a different budget scale. But there were incredible numbers of these films. So go for it. You take it away there.
Oh, I was just going to say, RoboCop. I adore RoboCop.
Oh,
man.
God. I've got a reputation for talking far too much about RoboCop. So, I'll say nothing.
Okay. RoboCop is like, and this is what I'm talking about. RoboCop is a perfect example of that pulp vibe, that current going through to like more modern times. RoboCop is kind of absurd. It's a little bit silly. It's over the top, egregiously violent. It's like, it's nutty, but it's got this, it's just wonderful. It's just this great, entertaining, awesome, great color palettes. The acting is hilarious and just, it's got charm. It's enchanting. It is just a great piece of art. And what I argue is that these things are not, it's just not just consumer garbage. This was meaningful art forms for us. And it might not be quite as grandiose as something like Wagner or something like, marble statues in ancient Greece. It might not be as grandiose as that, but I'll tell you what, if you took Wagner or you took the guys making the statues in ancient Greece and you sat them down today and like showed them RoboCop, they would think it's fucking cool. They would be blown away, right? They would love it. You know, you took Wagner, you sit him down and made him listen to a Halloween album or Black Sabbath or a Dio album or something like that. He would like be into it, right? We just have this this innate, inborn self-hatred that what we do today sucks. It'll never be as good as our ancestors. And, you know, some of that is true. Our ancestors are our superiors. They're our betters, right? We should strive to be more like them at all times. But that doesn't mean that what we're doing now is no good. And it doesn't mean that it's not meaningful to us in this time, because what we're creating today, what we created in the 90s, in the 80s, in the pulp days, this is part of what Tolkien called the pot of soup. Right? He called it the cauldron of stories. It is part of the ancestral lineage, the mythopoetica that goes all the way back into the mists of time. We are the same people. You know, if you're like me and you believe in reincarnation, you understand that we are the same people spiritually as our ancestors. So what we create today is meaningful to us. If we don't keep creating, we're going to break the lineage. And that terrifies me. You know, a character like, if you say, who is the number one fantasy macho man hero of all time, most people will probably say Conan, right? Conan the Barbarian is such a badass. Robert E. Howard was such a dragon, right? This was such a cool character. But Conan the Barbarian, in my view, is not different than Beowulf. He's not different than Odysseus. He's not different than King Arthur. And while these heroes that I'm talking about from the ancient times, these are guys that are come from like sacred poetry and ancestral writing and stuff, from these types of ballads that were written in meter and like all this kind of stuff. But Conan was Robert E. Howard's version, right? That was their continuation. That was his continuation of the lineage. And we got to continue that. We got to continue imaginative storytelling, because it's the oldest art form that connects us spiritually back all the way to our very primordial beginnings. It's the mythopoetic current. And we have to keep telling stories, even if it is in our time, even if it is a little absurd, a little silly, a little like over the top, like RoboCop or like Heavy Metal the movie or like Terminator 2 or Blade Runner or like, I don't know, this whatever awesome 80s, 90s movie you can think of, right? Pretty much every Arnold movie ever. You know, if you could think of like these are just part of the lineage. And I just think it's so important for us to create this. And the reason that I went with pulp when I started the Bizarrechives was because I wanted to do something that we could start with, something that we could that was familiar, that was still in our recent memory, something that is accessible and affordable, something that our guys can create that doesn't require thousands and thousands or millions of dollars of budget. I started the Bizarrechives with 200 lousy bucks that I had left over from my stimulus check, right? I lost my job. I lost everything. I was so miserable, depressed, and terrible. I was like, I got to create something. So I created the Bizarrechives with 200 lousy bucks. I called up my artist buddy, Mr. Don Kent. Shout out, Mr. Don Kent. And I created this. And now we got this whole scene going, right? And, you know, I wasn't the first one. There was like a bunch of guys doing this already. So it's just like we got to keep the art form going. And the reason that I did this is because I don't really view us as so much as like a movement per se. I kind of see us as this secession from modernity, right? Modernity has become so monstrous, has become so rotten, has become so just it is a rusting, slowly falling machine that it's not going to be here forever. It has lost its hold on everybody, and there are people breaking off and splitting off. And the way that I see it is, we're kind of like, this is where we live now. This little underbelly of society, this necromunda, we live here now. So we should also have little venues, right? It should be like back in the 80s and 90s when we had venues that we'd go see bands at, right? Had little like circles of guys that played heavy metal, guys that played punk rock. There's guys over here who play country music, right? Have little genres and little subcultures within our culture, and become a core of creative essence that kind of pulsates outward and exports new culture into the broader world. And we're doing it. You know, we're doing it. The Bizarre Archives, like I said, we started with $200. We are now a top 10% publisher in the world. We are top 10% publisher in the world. And we're not even the biggest one, like in the underground. Guys like my boy Imperium Press, he blows us out. Like, we have serious power. We have not yet in the big picture, but we're holding something that has a lot of potential. And I want there to be fun cultural things. I want to create culture. And I just think that we have a lot of talent. We have a lot of potential. And, you know, I just think that we need something other than reading news cycles and getting blackpilled all the time. We should do things that are fun. And
the vacuity of mainstream fiction, mainstream popular culture. I mean, it's just absolutely, I mean, it's not just that it's crap, it's soulless. You know, I think that's the fundamental complaint that I would have about it, is that it's made by committee, and you can tell, it actually feels like it was made by committee, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it came from, it doesn't feel like it came from anywhere sincere or human.
Yeah. You look at the first Star Wars movie, right? You look at the first Star Wars movie, which might, you know, this is an unpopular take. In my opinion, it's the only Star Wars movie. I reject all other Star Wars movies. There was only one. So you look at the first Star Wars movie, that was clearly the vision of one man, right? You look at all of these great things. You look at Halloween, right? The first Halloween movie, clearly the vision of one man, one really imaginative, brilliant guy, probably a little crazy, but, you know, they don't have that anymore. They don't lift up these geniuses to create like imaginative, awesome things by themselves. They have these corporate committees of talentless weirdos that come together to try to create something that is one size fits all and lifts up their ESG score. That's all that it's about.
Yeah. Yeah. Awful. Just absolutely awful. I mean, it surprises me as you say that Halloween, that John Carpenter is actually still with us. You know, because it feels, and Ridley Scott as well, you know, it's kind of surprising because they really feel like from another age now, which is a rather dark thing to say. But anyway, let's get to the issue of something that occurred to me while you were talking about pulp fiction, weird fiction, is that it does seem something that's extremely white, extremely European, and it's I cannot imagine Arabs doing something like this, or the Chinese, or really anyone except Northern, well, except Europeans. Well, what would you say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 100% a reflection of our folk soul. This is a folk thing to do, is to tell these kinds of stories. And that's not saying that there aren't other people and other cultures that aren't gifted storytellers. There's plenty of East Asian cultures, Indus Valley cultures and stuff that are just wonderful storytellers, right? There's so many great ones. But when it comes to like what we're talking about here, this is like white boy shit. You know what I mean? This is stuff that comes out of our ancestry. It's using motifs and themes that exist from that are borrowed and that were inspired by like our ancient myth, the stories of our people, right? Those myths, like the poetic Edda, you know, Ajax, Iliad, like these kinds of things, Beowulf. This is like, those are the stories of our people, right? And we borrow those motifs, and fantasy and sci-fi and all of these things are built using those motifs. You can't have these genres. You can't have these art forms without European mythology, without European motifs, period, right? Is that to say that you can't do, for example, another guy that's in the pulp scene, he's on Twitter. He goes by Conan Esquire. He's, I think he's a Hispanic guy. He does these books here. His name's Alexander Palacio. And it's like a sword and sorcery kind of thing like Conan, except it's like Mesoamerican. There's like Aztec beings in it and stuff like that. So, you could do it, right? And I think it could be interesting if done. But, it's like you can't do it without us. You know what I mean?
Absolutely not. And it would be difficult to really nail down what it is specifically about this. But all I can say is it just seems extremely us, not something. And science fiction as well, I think, it just seems like it's something for us. And, you know, maybe and some Japanese, you know, but definitely not no one else. So, I can see that being... Well, that leads to the next question, is the role of this in terms of the culture war. How would you define the culture war first? What is it? Because obviously people, it's a very well-known term at this point, but I wonder if people use it to mean the same thing. What do you mean by it?
So the culture war, in my view, is now obviously there's people that have different leanings and different other subgenres and subsects and et cetera, but effectively the culture war comes down to there was a split that happened somewhere between some people go all the way back to Greek philosophers or even before that, the Axial Age or whatever. But in my view, there was a split that happened. There's a crack that created with Enlightenment philosophy and a split that happened probably in the 50s and 60s, where you have people that believe this revolutionary propositional like liberal universalism. And then you have people that believe in nature. Right. And pretty much this culture war is effectively you have progressives that believe that the old days are bad, that they themselves must be placed upon the throne of God and transcend above nature, and going forward is always good. And you have people that do not want to be liberated from nature, that believe that these ordering forces of nature, like we were talking about before, Weird and Urlog and Dharma, et cetera, Logos, these kinds of things are forces of good. That these things are good in reality, and that we should base our societies and our lives and our ethics and all of the above off of these rules. And these two groups are not just incompatible, but are hostile to one another and can't coexist. That is the culture war, in my view.
Well, that's a very interesting summary of it. I haven't heard it said like that before. So what, in that case, how does this weird fiction and pulp fiction, how does that become relevant to the culture war?
So I really think that pulp fiction and weird fiction are really effective in the, I don't want to frame it like, I'm very.
Oh no, and I wouldn't want to do it that late. Well, okay, so why are you here, a millennial, to tell me the relevance? I don't want it to be like that, but clearly we do have that interest in common. So
of course,
you know, go for it.
So I am very careful, as I'm very against propaganda being mixed in with art. I am somebody that believes thoroughly that art must be autonomous of any sort of like this kind of stuff. I think when you define art, in my view, now this is like going to start so many arguments about what art is, but in my view, all art is fantasy, and what makes something fantasy is immersion. So when you include things like propaganda, which is a technology, you are rattling somebody out of there. You are breaking their immersion. And therefore, you cannot create art. So I'm very careful about how I frame pulp fiction insofar as it's a tool in the culture war. Because we create pulp fiction because we love it, and because we love the art form and we want to create it. And however, if you are going to look at it as something that is in the culture war, like I said before, they can't cancel Lovecraft. They can't cancel Robert E. Howard. They can't cancel Conan. They can't cancel these characters, these writers. They can't cancel their style. They've been trying. If you look at pretty much everybody that comes out of Penguin Random House or Tor Books or any of these big feminist publishers, they literally their identity is anti-Lovecraft. They've been trying to subvert and destroy him forever, and they just can't do it. Pulp Fiction provides something that is antithetical, that is against, that is the antithesis of our enemies in the culture war, insofar as it upholds things like masculinity. It upholds things like motion and action and style and excitement and irrationality and primordial themes and mythopoetic motifs and all of these kinds of things that they just can't, they have no, it short circuits them, right? They don't even know why they hate pulp. They don't know why they can't write it, right? They can't write it because they can't write a big masculine dude saving a girl. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look at the Rings of Power. You know, they probably think, why can't we equal Tolkien? Why can't we do this? And what is the secret? What is the alchemy that I think they would desperately like to love to equal that and supplant the original and update it, you know, posify it. But the truth is, people don't like women. They want a character like, and I remember Morgoth made this point about the Game of Thrones prequel. I've forgotten what it's called now, but he made the point that there was a character, the main character in that is a rogue. So you've not got, as with Galadriel in the Rings of Power, you've got this girl boss. Women don't actually like that. What they like is the rogue character who will be exciting. So you end up returning to a male archetype, and that blows the competition away. That blows the wokery away, because the wokery does not apply to human nature. It doesn't appeal to people's actual drives, whereas the traditional archetypes do.
Yeah, they're sewn, they're woven into our very being, into the very soul stuff that make us us. You can't get rid of it. You know what I mean? That's why there's tropes. I know that some people consider that a dirty word. I do not think that that's a dirty word. Tropes are flavors from Tolkien's cauldron of stories. And the reason that there's tropes is because these things are archetypes or motifs that are just true. They're part of who we are. They invoke emotion. We like them and we'll never stop liking them. And the leftoids, the goblins, right? These homunculi, they do not, that drives them insane that they can't destroy it. That drives them insane that they can't make new ones. They just drives them nuts that they just can't compete. That some Joe Schmo jerk off can write a heroic story about a muscle bound Giga Chad just punching the shit out of a bunch of bad guys and getting a pretty girl at the end. And guys, you know, everybody, oh, that was a good story. And then this postmodern, self-reflective, subversive, ironic garbage that they make, people are like, this blows. Above what transcends politics, what transcends all of this stuff is whether you do something that's good or you do something that blows. And they're going to be forever remembered as the folks that made stuff that blew. And that it's like they're losers. Who wants to be a loser? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I wonder what they're going to do with the Rings of Power, actually, because I think it's 2 years before the next season comes out. I think the people in charge of it have been fired and replaced. I'm not sure. But also, they can't change. I mean, surely they've had to plan ahead. So, I mean, I don't know how much they can change it. But anyway, I guess we'll hear about it when it happens.
Let me ask you a question. So, Rings of Power, everybody's fired. Millennial Woes is now in charge. What would you do to turn the show around?
Oh, no. Don't ask me, because I don't know enough about Lord of the Rings. I'm not the... It's rather surprising. You might think that... You might expect me to be the kind of guy who knows Lord of the Rings very well. I actually don't. So I wouldn't be the person to do it. But what I would certainly do, just, you know, let's say that I'm in charge. What would I do? The first thing I would do is get in Tolkien experts. people who could do, who have the knowledge that I certainly don't have. I would, and they actually, of course, you'll probably know this, they fired this Tolkien expert while they were working on the Rings of Power. I've forgotten his name now, but he was like the foremost Tolkien sort of guy, and they got rid of him. Well, that's, I mean, that was an immediate harbinger of the direction that they were taking it in. I would reverse that. That would be the first thing I would do, is reverse it and bring in other experts as well. I'd want to soak it in the people who know about this and love it for the right reasons. This is an interesting thing, and it's happened with sci-fi. I mean, I was into Doctor Who. It's happened with Star Trek. It's happened with Star Wars. Sometimes the people who really are in, you can get people who are really into something, but they really shouldn't be, you know. They're idiots, and even though they do enjoy the thing, they can only subvert it, and they might not even do it consciously. Although I think in our age they do it consciously, but either way, it's all they can do to it. I mean, I remember, for example, you'll maybe know a British sci-fi comedy called Red Dwarf, and I remember listening to this. This is an interesting thing, actually. It was a bunch of fans who watched an episode, or they were discussing the new season of it, and it hasn't been good for a long, long time. I mean, I wish they would, yeah. But anyway, so there were these four fans got together, recorded a podcast thing where they were all discussing it, and one of them was a woman, and she said something like, "Oh yeah, there was this sexist joke in it about." That when a guy gets a girlfriend, she starts policing his which friends he can have, or she tries to take over his life, something like that. And this woman was saying that that's a sexist joke because it's stereotyping women or whatever. But the thing is, it's bloody true. And the thing is, I wonder, so what has this woman likes Red Dwarf? And I believe that now, because there's the cliche that she doesn't actually, it's like the gamer girl thing. She doesn't actually like video games. She's just in it for the, you know, male attention. But I suspect that this girl actually did like Red Dwarf. And I suspect that her feelings about it would be echoed by the male viewers as well. The sort of soy boys who have found themselves into something slightly based. But now they're immersed in modern ideas, so now they've got to take this thing that they like and ruin it. Yeah. And it's like they're compelled to do that, even though that will then make it less enjoyable for them. But they have to do it because they don't know any. They can't justify continuing to like something that is out of date in terms of its social ideas.
Yeah.
Weird, isn't it?
Yeah, they have the propagandized mind, right? Their mind is propagandized. There's a few good books. I hate just telling people to read books because it's like, you know, it's just read these three books. You can understand this one idea that I'm talking about. Yeah, but there's a few good books about propaganda. I would check out. There's a guy named Jacques Ellul. He wrote Technological Society. He also has a book called Propaganda, and he's really, really good with describing what propaganda is. And the way that he describes it is effectively that propaganda is a technique, and what it does is it inserts technology into your brain, right? It inserts this technique into your brain, becomes somewhat of a mind virus, creates what we would understand to be a light switch brain or binary thought. Because the purpose of propaganda is not to for example, art. When you view art, you experience art, it kind of like thrusts upon you this, like, it throws you into this world of imagination. It throws you into another world. It throws you into a fantasy. Propaganda doesn't do that. Propaganda shoots into your brain and writes a bunch of code in there so you could follow certain algorithms according to certain stimulation. In fact, this was actually professionalized by a German psychologist named Dr. Wilhelm Wundt, and he called it operative conditioning. And this actually, the techniques that he used actually got picked up by guys named John Dewey and B.F. Skinner, who went on to create the entirety of Western public school systems. So it's like this operative conditioning, propagandized mind stuff is pretty spooky, and how far back it goes and how deep it is in our psyches. But people that have this, like you're describing, is 100%. You see it all the time. For example, Warhammer 40K. Press 9 in the chat if you're a 40K guy. Glory to the Emperor. But anyway, these 40K fans will come in, like these like libtoad, goofball, soy boys come in, and they're like, oh man, I like this Primarch. I like this. They get into 40K, and they can't help but like try to turn and destroy the thing that they love. They're like a plague of locusts. They just go from corpse to corpse, host to host, sucking the life and the everything good out of it and leaving behind these dried husks, right? They can't stop. And this is because they're just infected by this mind virus of light switch brain. Well, oh my God, here's this thing. This can't exist. We have to get rid of it. And the bottom line is that those things that trigger their light switch brain are part of the core, the foundation that make the thing cool in the first place that attracted them. So it's like this, they have this lemming, you know, situation going on.
Yeah, it is a very strange thing. But I think what we've discovered certainly recently is that people are very susceptible to this kind of thing, where you can implant I don't know what you'd call it, like a setup and payoff thing, where in their heads, where okay, this thing now equals this. So when you see this thing react in this way, and it happens, it works. I mean, unvaccinated, you know.
Yeah.
I think for normies, the term unvaccinated, which would have been a fairly neutral term beforehand, now is a sort of horror term. Something to elicit disgust and shock and fear. Amazing, absolutely amazing how that's happened. There was a question that was asked earlier before we move on. Are you aware of H.P. Lovecraft's friendship with Arthur Machen? Are you?
Yep, Arthur Machen. Oh my God, what a master. Yeah, Arthur Machen is one of Lovecraft's like big inspirations. We were actually going to release a Arthur Machen collection. It was a real big boy. There's some like concerns about the copyright or whatever, so we released it for free on our Substack. So guys can go over and sub to our get the premium to our Substack, and you can get the Arthur Machen collection. Arthur Machen is like the godfather of supernatural horror. You know, the white people of the Black Seal. You got the Great God Pan. He really invented supernatural and folk horror, and Lovecraft really, really looked up to him. And if you read Machen, you see a lot of like stylistic things that Lovecraft borrowed from him, describing things as unnameabilities and things of blasphemous proportions and form, and these like writhing, crawling. You know, he borrowed a lot of that style of description from Arthur Machen, this ornate, very verbose style of like crawling, you know. So
I love the idea of something being of blasphemous proportions. It's absurd. Well, the question continues. Do you buy Robert M. Price's theory that the character Ephraim Waite was based upon Arthur Edward Waite of Golden Dawn fame?
I'm not sure.
Right, okay. I don't know what that's a reference to. But anyway, thank you for that that question. Hold on a second. Right, okay. Yeah, all right. So then I guess that brings us to the next thing which I was going to ask you, hold on a second. Let me see this. Oh, yeah. Are there other pulp publishers like yours, like the Bizarrkives? But you did mention a few. So do you want to go into that now?
So there's like the pulp scene is like really popping, man. It's like we came on, and there's a few others that were kind of on the same track before us. But like lots of others have been cropping up. I'm very proud to think that that the Bizarrkives may have inspired people to create their own pulp works. And I'll show you guys some right now. You know, Mr. Woj, you're probably familiar with this. Aegon Sci-Fi Illustrated from Mr. Brendan Hurd from Aureus Press.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah, I have every copy of it. This is his first one. You got a fella named Sam Carnes. him and Paul Wagner started, I couldn't find it, but Savage Frontiers. You have, let me see what else we got, man. We got a, there's like a bunch. Yeah, I got another book, Dream God. That's from Brendan Heard. You know, I showed you the, what was that? The Turquoise Serpent from Conan Esquire. Here's a fella. I just found this. Dude, I buy these pulp indies all over the place. I put aside like $100 every month and just buy books from people. But this is a guy. He goes by, his name's Dave West, but he also goes by James Alderdice, Brutal Sword Saga. It's like a sword and sorcery. Here's one of the big boys in the pulp scene. You got DMR Books. So if you like old school Conan, Jack Vance kind of stuff, that's them. Shout out Kursova Magazine. Like there's a lot of these folks. There's only just like a handful of them, right? You got Story Hack Magazine. There's like tons and tons of these like cool indie pulp publications from guys like us that are writing cool you know, fiction stories, doing these pulp compilations, up and coming authors, guys that are like really like starting to get names for themselves. For example, I don't have a copy to show you because I'm so sold out. But our author, A. Cuthbertson, who's a an Englishman, he's actually he's a Geordie. He made it on the top on the bestseller list in the UK. He's a UK bestseller, one of our authors, and with his book Spire.
Ah, yes. Now he'll be talking about that when he comes on. He's going to be coming on to talk about the Toadstool magazine.
Oh, yeah. That's my dude, AC.
So, yeah, he'll no doubt talk about that then. So it is obviously a very happening scene. That is good to know. I mean, would you say that the internet has helped or hindered this?
Oh, yeah. It's we probably wouldn't be able to do this without the internet at this point. Things like print-on-demand services like Ingram Spark and, you know, Amazon, even though I know that they're the big monster, Amazon is a big greedy corporation and they don't really pay much attention to what they publish. So a lot of our guys, you know, it flies under the radar. What are we doing? We're writing, you know, fiction stories. We're writing about barbarians and robots and, you know, sci-fi horror and, you know, spooky stories and like we're all over the place with this. So what are they going to do? Shut it down for being like fiction? Like they don't even notice. So using their infrastructure, guys like us are publishing these books and like selling a good amount of books. And you know, guys going through things like Ingram Spark and, you know, there's other ones too, Lulu, Book Baby, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's guys that are using that as a stepping stool to like start printing their own books, doing their own fulfillment and shipping and distribution. And there's just like, it's like a growing industry. It really, really is.
That's fantastic, because I mean, I know from personal experience that if you can make your living from doing the thing you love, I mean, it's great. You know, it's the best job in the world if you can do that. I mean, if there are guys, especially on our side, who can make a living from this, from producing this, I think that's terrific.
Yeah. Now, I will say this. It's not like you're going to walk in and make $1 million. It's something that you got to, it's something you do on the side. It's something you got to invest time into over a long period of time. It's a lot of grind. It's something you only do if you really, really love it. You know what I mean? We could go into what it takes to actually start turning it into something lucrative, but I think most people get involved with this just because they want to see their names in print. The Bizarchives are authors. A lot of them got like blackballed by, you know, I'm sure everybody saw that Carol Oates creature on Twitter say that she saw that literary agents are just turning away manuscripts from white males.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do remember that. Yeah, that Carol Oates. Yeah, that was shocking. That was absolutely amazing. I mean, it shouldn't be amazing, but when it's that explicit, you know, you realize our mainstream culture, or the mainstream culture in our societies, is now really has it in for us in a massive way. I mean, nothing is accidental at this point.
Yeah, I call these industry fempub, right? These big publishers like Tor and Penguin Random House, and obviously the guys that are all the way at the top of it, the execs are, you know who's, but staffing it from like top to bottom. If you go to like a convention, you will find these like frumpy box frame glasses, cat ladies wearing sweatpants that have bad breath, and it just have these like just sour, droopy, horrible faces. These like just barren witches, these like harpies. You will see these creatures by the thousand. They run the entire thing top to bottom, and they're just completely black heart, horrible, terrible creatures. And they hate white men, and they lift up these mediocre talents. And it's just like, let me tell you, a bunch of the Bizarrechives authors. Let me tell you, you dig into some of our authors, not some, but yeah, all of our authors, I believe, are good, but some of our guys are really, really in a fairer, more just time would be stars. And they got turned away. They got blackballed. They got cold shouldered by an industry that hates them and doesn't want them. They sit in the castle. They sit in the grand halls, the crumbling old decrepit halls that were once great, that were built by great men like Tolkien, like Lovecraft, like Howard. They sit in their halls and they use the foundation that was built by these giants to turn around and blaspheme their names and curse their names and spit on them and try to destroy and subvert the tradition. But here's the deal with it. As we said before, these creatures, they do not have the talent and the soul stuff. They're small souled. They don't have the essence to create like our great literary forefathers did. So now we're coming for them, right? We are the barbarians at the gates here to reclaim our beloved literary traditions. You know what? Some people might say, oh, well, this is just, you know, these are just books or whatever. But you know what? These things are meaningful to so many of us. And if we don't create it, they will. And they are going to destroy it. So this belongs to us. So we have so many, the Bizarrechives has so many authors that were turned away by this rotten industry, FemPub, and that deserve to like tell stories because they just have this wonderful talent. And it's just like, it just makes me crazy. But you know what? They're lost because now these guys are working with us and we're putting their books out and people are reading them. And it's, you know, we don't need them. We don't need them. We'll build our own. This is why I started, you know, I started Bizarrechives because some smarmy libtoad told me to make my own. Like, oh, you don't like it? Make your own. Well, fuck around and find out. Now I did.
Excellent. Okay, well, let's get to that and talk about the different series from the Bizarrechives, and then sure, we can get to the, go for that.
So we have, obviously, hang on, let me pull some books up here. I'm a little bit discombobulated because
you must be surrounded by different piles of books.
Oh my god, you wouldn't believe. There's a reason that I have a green screen up. You don't even want to see what's going on in this place. Hold up. It's a fucking disaster, this place. Oh my goodness. Let me see if I can find. Oh, Jesus Christ. I can't find Bizarrechives 4. Oh, here we are. Here we go. Okay, so here's Bizarrechives 4. This is issue number 4 of our of our main series, which is just called the Bizarrechives. It's got lots of cool art in here. Art from artist of Albion, Donald Kent's in here, Arturi Kivella, lots of great guys. We have Bizarrechives 3 right here, which actually all of the art on the inside was done by Mr. Brandon Hurd. Or Brendan Hurd, he's just a fantastic, multi-talented guy, just really, really great artist. And then Arturi Kivella did the cover art there, Bizarrechives 1 and 2. We're up to issue 4 on Bizarrechives, and then also we have our legacy series, which I only have one of our legacy series. I'm sold out of all the other stuff. But here's Masters of Horror, which has stories from Arthur Machen. We talk about Arthur Machen, Algernon Blackwood, Edgar Allan Poe, Clark Ashton Smith, H.P. Lovecraft, and Robert E. Howard. We have some copies left of this over on our website. If you're in the U.S. of A., you can order at thebizarrechives.com/shop. So we have this. We have Man in the 25th Century, which is the first two Buck Rogers novellas written by Philip Francis Nolan in the late 1920s. So we have Man in the 25th Century. We have The Willows. We have, what else we got? We got it. Like, we have a bunch of those. We have our Bizarchives Presents series, which, hang on one second. I'm sorry, Mr. Webbs. I'm all.
Don't worry. Take your time. It's absolutely fine. Believe me, I know how it can be.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people probably wouldn't believe it, but my room is actually quite untidy as well.
I also think that, you know, we're creative minded people, and creative minded people are just like notoriously, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not even embarrassed about it. I don't care.
Yeah. My wife gets so mad. My wife is like a neat person. Yeah. She's just always, why would you even put that there? That doesn't make any sense. Why is it standing there? I don't, cause I'm like, no, I didn't think about it. Like, what do you do? Why are you breaking my balls? Come on.
Yeah.
But no, I love my wife. My wife is wonderful. But so here's Arbogast Shanghai Horror. This is part of the Bizarchives Presents series, which are novellas that are put out by our guys. Another one, Cosmic Horror Double Feature by A. Cuthbertson, who's also the editor-in-chief of Toadstool Magazine. I actually have a copy of Toadstool Magazine. I didn't prepare it. But yeah, he wrote this. He also wrote Spire, which I mentioned was a bestseller in the UK. He made up to number 12 on the charts in the UK. So he was like beating out like Philip K. Dick and William Gibson and like all like these like big the greats of the cyberpunk genre. He like was beating them out. So he made it to number 12 on that. We're really proud of him for that. And then another presents. This is going to be an 8-part series. Mr. M.S. Jones, Marcus S. Jones, another Englishman. A lot of our writers are English guys. We got like a nice, it's like a 50-50 mix of English guys and American guys, which I actually find really fascinating because I get to firsthand see kind of the writing instincts and how they're different between Americans and Englishmen or British people. So it's pretty interesting. But this is like an epic fantasy 8-part series. This is the first book, Sacred Times, part one of the Chronicles of Horaldria. So if you like Lord of the Rings, you like epic fantasy, this is what you're looking for. We got all kinds of good books, man. I'm telling you.
I've got to say, you know, something that strikes me just seeing the covers now is the covers look damn good.
Thank you.
It's a thing with them. It's a difficult thing to get right. But they look really professional, and I hope that doesn't sound patronizing. I don't mean it at all in that way.
I didn't know. Actually, that's a compliment to me. I had no idea what I was doing when I started doing this. So it looks professional. Hell yeah, I made it.
Yeah, it looks lovely.
Yeah, there's yeah, we got, man, I'm just so proud of our guys, and we got a lot of good stuff. So you guys out there, if you're reading, if you're in the mood for some fiction and you want to read something that's imaginative, the one thing that we like brevity, we like accessibility, we like affordable price points. So you go, a lot of our books are like $10 and under. They're like 100 pages. They're bite-sized. You can read them in a like long car ride or, you know, a few sessions. It's not like these big giant tomes like Dune or something, which, you know, nothing against Dune. Dune's a masterpiece. But, you know, a lot of guys like me, I'm a dad. I got 3 kids. I got work. I'm doing book business. I'm a busy guy. So I don't have time to read stuff like Dune or Lord of the Rings anymore. So I love these bite-sized books, and this is what we're putting out there for guys that have the short attention spans. You know what I mean? Whether we like it or not, we're born in this era. Our attention spans are what they are. So we just wanted to contour to how people are today, because what's important to us is to make reading cool again and to make stories fun again and to kind of give people some relief and let them have some healthy escapism reading about cool stories from guys that are like them, have similar values to them. So that's like, you know, that's what we're all about.
Excellent. One question is, you've obviously gone for the paper print route, but are they also available as ebooks, or have you decided against that?
No, we have ebooks. A lot of our, we have a bunch of ebooks that are available on Amazon, but we also have ebooks through our Substack. So if you go sign up to our Substack, it's only $5 a month, or like it's like $50 a year or something like that. You go sign up, you get free ebooks every month. A lot of stuff doesn't even make it to print. We're just spitting this stuff out for the people, for our supporters. So that helps us out tremendously, and it pays for itself right away. If you're somebody that has a Kindle or a whatever, you know, ebook reader, it pays for itself in like the first month. So go sign up over there. We give you free ebooks. You get all the Bizarre Archives, all of our releases beforehand, plus other ones. Like I said, we sent out that Arthur Macken book. We even sent out kids books and stuff. We're going to start getting into kids books up here pretty soon, but we sent out a reprint of a kids pulp, called The Six Gun Gorilla, which was in Wizard magazine in 1925 or something. It's literally about a gorilla cowboy, and it's like awesome for little boys that want to read about, you know, gorillas and cowboys.
Right, okay, that's great. I'm sorry that I forgot to have the overlay graphic for most of your streams. I apologize, but nonetheless, I'm sure it's been visually interesting nonetheless. So the other thing that you wanted to talk about was the video game, Grimearth.
Yeah, Grimearth. One of the things that I think is important is for us to, like, because we are like an art movement now, the pulp scene and like all of the little adjacent scenes, we are an art movement. We are a blossoming art movement that is taking form and taking shape, and all of the people are getting involved with it. And there's lots of people talking about it and writing about it. And it's a lot of fun. Like, it's really blooming. And I think it's very important for us to take video games and film seriously. These are two art forms that are one and two of the biggest art forms in the world. Video games by far are the biggest, most widely consumed art form. If you want to call it an art form, I know there's some debate around that, but for brevity reason, we will just say, I like to say that it's an art form. It is a medium, nonetheless. We could say it's a medium. It is the most widely consumed one by far, by like million. There's not even a second place, right? So we got to take a stab at video games. We got to take a stab at video games. We got to take a stab at film, which real quick with film, my buddy Lord Wolfshield is creating an adaptation of a story from Bizarre Archives 1 in film called Baby Teeth. It's from the story Baby Teeth, and that's going to be coming out early next year. So January, February, guys, keep your eyes peeled for a film adaptation of a Bizarre Archives story. We're really looking for. So we're going into film. I actually have a film project I'm going to start working on in a couple months here, a sci-fi short. I don't know. I've never done a film before. I have no idea what I'm doing, but I have a pretty good track record of taking on things that I have no idea what I'm doing. So I'm pretty confident it'll turn out at least sort of good. So we'll see how that goes. But with video game, the video game, we created Grimearth, and it's a very small team. It's me, our lead developer, Fornall, who just like, this guy like deserves an award. This guy, thousands and thousands of hours of labor this guy put in to create this really cool 3D game. Arturi Chiavella, who's an artist that's involved with Bizarre Archives a lot. He did Bizarre Archives 3 cover. He does a lot of, he's a really talented Finnish guy artist, as well as Luke Mason of Imminent Rain. He's a one-man heavy metal band, does like 80s style trad metal. I got him on. He's also a really talented piano and synth player and stuff. So he's doing the music. So we put together this little underground super group. We raised a little bit of money to come up with this demo for this game. I was like, okay, we're gonna try to put this together. We got like $1,500, right? Which is like for a video game is nothing. And we came out with Grimearth, which originally the working title was Legends of Hyperborea, and we made a creative decision to change it. And what we came up with is a hack and slash old school retro RPG, action RPG that's sort of in the vein of something like Gauntlet Legends, for guys that remember that, or Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance, or maybe Diablo, or Dynasty Warriors. It's like all of these kind of like old school games that we liked, kind of put together in one and our own spin on it. So it's actually turned out really, really great. The demo, the beta is done. So we're going to get ready next year. We're going to do like a series of Kickstarters, of crowdfunding, because, you know, creating an entire 3D game is an absolutely monstrous undertaking. You know, it's like usually...
Is it an undertaking of blasphemous proportions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of mastodonic proportions. Yeah. So it really truly this is like something that entire teams of guys like spend years doing, and we got like four dudes, one developer, and we're getting ready to like take it all on ourselves. So we're gonna break up the funding in chunks so we can actually try to get this thing done. And it's gonna be like the first video game that's coming out of our spheres, and it looks pretty darn cool. And Woz, if you ever want to try it, man, I'll send it to you. You can try out the beta. You can play test it if you want. But I don't know if you play video games.
Thank you. I don't really, but but thank you. I just wouldn't be the right person to judge it. But I mean, I last played video games in like the mid-90s. it was, you know, that's my era, but probably your era as well.
Yep.
The Sega Genesis and all that. That's the last thing I know about video gaming. But yeah, it sounds fascinating. There is actually an Austrian video game developer called Cult Games
who's going to appear
on Millennial this year. So
yeah, shout out Cult Games.
Yeah, yeah, he's done very well with his stuff. I mean, it looks hilarious and really interesting because it's a way to capture the modern world in that format, in that way that certainly the mainstream won't be doing. And so it rings true in a way. You've got this like huge cyber Merkel, Angela Merkel. It's absolutely hilarious. Really good stuff. So he'll be on. But in terms of Grimearth, it's obviously not ready yet. You've done the beta, but you're going to be looking for more funding next year. So where can people find that? Is that linked from the Biz Archives?
You can go over to it. We only have it on Telegram right now. So you can go over to t.me/Grimearth, GRIMURTH, Grimearth, and go check it out over there. We got updates. We show art. We got little videos. We got all kinds of stuff over there, promo videos and stuff like that. So you can go check it out over there.
Excellent. It sounds like you've really started something here, and it's growing rapidly, and I'm, you know, very happy, and I hope it continues. I hope it keeps growing.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, we're working hard, man. We love this, and we believe that we can win, and we believe that we can create an alternative from the paused. This is the evil and the chaos out there, the subversive crap for us and our families, because, you know, we, like I said before, I view this as we kind of like, this is like our enclave away from modernity. And we got to have art, and we got to have fun, and we got to have cool things that we do, because there's so many interesting, creative, imaginative people around here that have these skills and have these talents, and so many people that just love this stuff. I'll tell you what, when I started the Biz Archives, I was a little concerned. I was not concerned, but I was like, we'll see where this goes, right? I didn't think people, and I got all of these stories start pouring in, submissions, people like, here is the goal that I want to set. I want to sell X amount of books before the end of the year. And I'll consider this somewhat of a success. I'll do another one. I blew out that goal by like 4 or 5 times in the first month. And people are reaching, yo, man, I've been waiting for base sword and sorcery. I've been waiting for more cosmic horror. It turns out that pretty much everybody I'm hanging out with is also like a huge fan of sci-fi or, cosmic horror or fantasy. They just like all the same stuff I do. I'm like, shit, okay. So we start doing it, and it's got legs, and man, we're just having so much fun, and we're starting to get to the point that it's starting to get a little bit lucrative. You know, I'm starting to I'm not so much worried about financial ruin or it's a beautiful thing, man. It's a beautiful thing, and just seeing everybody else being inspired and having fun and finding white pills in modern times, because I don't know. I'm not saying anybody's right or wrong or whatever, but in my view, I'm not sure that we can like go out and really change how things are going. This might be something that just has to run its course. And if that's true, man, we gotta like create our little enclave. We gotta hunker down in Necromunda, and we gotta have a good time, because life is a gift. Life is a beautiful thing. And it's just, we can't be wasting away being black-pilled and miserable about things that could possibly be out of our control. Let's let's buy cool books and read cool books and make cool video games and make awesome heavy metal music and do short films. And like, let's have fun and make a little money. And, you know, let's create a core culture that creates cultural exports. And then who knows, we might one day, you know, look how Hollyweird started, man. They started with just, you know, a bunch of those dudes just like in the desert with like one goofy stage they built out of plywood. You know what I mean? Like, we could go somewhere. We could have influence one day. I don't know.
All right. Let's I hope so. And good luck and well done so far. I mean, it just sounds great. And your enthusiasm is infectious, as some Thank people you. Have commented in the chat. So, all right. Excellent. Well, thank you, Dave Martell of the Bizarchives, for appearing on Millennial 8.
Thank you so much, Mr. Woes, and hails and blessings to all you guys. You guys have a very merry Yule, merry Christmas. I'll see you guys all very soon.
Okay, excellent. I'll be back in just over half an hour with the Distributist. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.